From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I discuss the former military dictator who's about to take over for Goodluck Jonathan as Nigeria's new president, and 24 looted artifacts recently returned to Italy.
They have an entire police force dedicated to looking for these artifacts. In fact, we have visited those headquarters and seen the data set they have to try to match each one of these.
Then Rebecca talks with war photographer Ashley Gilbertson. His most recent book, Bedrooms of the Fallen, depicts the homes of men and women who died in Iraq and Afghanistan to remember how they lived rather than how they died.
In these bedrooms is where we can feel that absence, but we can also feel what their lives were, how rich their lives were, how they expressed themselves. It's like a doorway.
Photographing war and the stories of the lives it touches. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca Cruz, let's start with Nigeria this week, where we have a presidential transition taking place. President Goodluck Jonathan is being replaced by a former military dictator in Nigeria, Muhammadu Buhari. He's known for his very harsh tactics. He was overthrown by a coup 30 years ago. Now, he says he's changed. That, I guess, remains to be seen. He's now an outspoken proponent of democracy and democratic transition, and he was democratically elected. I suppose in Nigeria, some question how corrupt the government is and how fair their elections are. But this is a country that has serious problems. We have terrorists in the north. Boko Haram operates there. We have lots of fuel shortages and financial problems. So the new president, President Buhari, has a lot to take on. And the question is what is that transition going to be like? And how is he going to be able to manage all of the very difficult problems that Nigeria faces?
As you mentioned, a pretty significant transfer of power. This is the first time that an elected official or an official in Nigeria has actually stepped down. So we can take this as a positive indication that perhaps democracy is becoming the norm in Nigeria. The first election, 2011, that these two men came head to head and Goodluck Jonathan won, is thought to be the first election that was relatively free and fair. So we can take some solace in the fact that democracy seems to be heading in the right direction there. But yes, as you mentioned, this is a gentleman who is a military dictator. Came to power in the 1980s with a military coup, was then ousted by another military coup, and there are some serious questions about how he is going to lead, but he claims that he is an opportunist, that he has seen the light, and that he is going to make policies that are more democratic. But yes, there's a lot going on in Nigeria. Boko Haram continues to be an issue since their appearance, if you will, in 2009, about 15,000 people have been killed. 1.5 million have been displaced. That's a significant number of people in what has just been named this last year as Africa's largest economy. So a growing player in the international realm. And even this week, we see the military is trying to close ranks a little bit. 200 people were fired because they were displaying cowardice in fighting Boko Haram. And as many as 4,000 others are being questioned and potentially will be let go as well. That's one issue, dealing with the North. But this idea of them having a fuel crisis is really somewhat complex and a little
It's perplexing because Nigeria is Africa's largest oil-producing and exporting state, and yet they have fuel shortages in their cities there. I mean, this is so hard to understand.
Well, I think the key word is producing state. They are producing a great number of barrels of oil. They are exporting it, but it's the importing. They don't have the capacity to refine the oil, so they have to actually purchase it to get it back in. They have put on a significant subsidy so that it can then be sold to the people at about $1.50, $1.60 a gallon, which we would be very happy to pay here. But the government hasn't been paying these importers, and so there's been stalled shipments in, and that's where the issue is coming from. This was resolved this week potentially by the president as he was leaving office, and we'll see how the new president does coming up with next week and the future.
Well, it's an important country. We'll definitely continue to watch Nigeria. Well, off to Italy, a little different story. 25 artifacts, historical artifacts, are being returned to Italy right now. Antiquities that had been trafficked out of the country, some dating back to the first century BC. These have been found in the United States. They had been smuggled to the United States. They were found in museums, auction houses, art galleries, private collections in cities all across the United States, Toledo, San Francisco, Minneapolis, Baltimore. So this is obviously the work of smugglers getting this stuff out of Italy. And law enforcement trying to collect the stuff and bring it back in. But what are we to make of this, Rebecca? I mean, we don't often talk about trafficking in antiquities and art, although it is a huge market and a big problem around the world, particularly in countries like Italy.
Definitely a huge market. And if we think of Italy having the rich cultural heritage that it has, these artifacts are valuable to them, but perhaps not as valuable in our mind if we think of humans or guns, those things that have immediate consequences. But this is their cultural history. They have an entire police force dedicated to looking for these artifacts. In fact, we have visited those headquarters and seen the data set they have. They try to match each one of these. And so this was a really big and significant haul, if you will, or returning these artifacts. Just a couple months ago in January, there were actually over 5,000 artifacts that were found in Switzerland and other parts of Europe that were also returned, but they weren't as significant. But a very serious and ongoing situation, and in many cases a losing battle, as these artifacts are easy to transport, easy to forge. The documentation that goes with them is easy to replicate. And so this will be an ongoing struggle. But for these artifacts that have returned, that is a victory for the Italian people to have that cultural relevance returned.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the false documentation. I mean, that's a big part of this process. Many would say they don't focus on art and antiquities trafficking because it's kind of victimless. But there is violence and crime being associated with this type of activity. However, no criminal charges in this case. I mean, this happened over the past 10 to 15 years. They can't necessarily track down those who were ultimately responsible. And some people and museums, perhaps, and others that purchase these items actually don't know that they're buying looted, stolen goods. So it really complicates this very difficult issue. But yes, good for Italy to have its history returned. And they will be displayed in local museums where these items were looted.
Absolutely. And we hope to have more of these cases with successful results in the future.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Rebecca, as always, for being here.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Grolot and at Cruise226. This conversation and all of our past episodes are online at KGOU.org. Coming up, Rebecca talks with war photographer and journalist Ashley Gilbertson, who chronicled the stories of military members who served in Iraq and Afghanistan in his book, Bedrooms of the Fallen. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot. Our guest today is Ashley Gilbertson. He spent 6 years photographing the war in Iraq, and now focuses on issues like post-traumatic stress disorder and veteran suicide for Time magazine. His series of pictures of the intact bedrooms of military members who died in Iraq and Afghanistan was published by the New York Times Magazine and earned the National Magazine Award for Documentary Photography. It was turned into a standalone book in 2012. He spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Ashley Gilbertson, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Well, you are an internationally known photographer, and I wanted to just start by asking you why you came to photography or how you came to photography. Is this something that you came across as a child or something that came a little bit later in life? What is it about photography that really speaks to you as a medium of art and of expression and of telling a story?
I started shooting when I was 13, and like any 13-year-old, I was a self-obsessed teenager, and I wanted pictures of myself skateboarding. So I bought I begged my dad and my mom for a camera, and they bought me a little camera, and I realized immediately that I couldn't take pictures of myself doing tricks. So I started photographing my friends, who happened to be really good, and it was about a year later that I published my first picture in a skateboarding magazine. And that feeling of seeing something happen, take a photograph of it, and then see it in a magazine and show thousands of people, you know, this thing that you had seen was... I mean, it was totally addictive. It was like, it was such a, it's magical, you know, to be the messenger, like, don't shoot me, haha, but like, it's the best thing. It was absolutely satisfying. And it gave me permission from then on, once I was this sort of accredited photographer, to go into spaces that I wouldn't otherwise be allowed to go into. And in a skateboarding sense, that might have been parks. It might have been people that I hung out with that were much, much better than, you know, I could ever be. But then in a broader sense, you know, in the photographic world that I now sort of inhabit, I get to be on the sidelines of history and watch all of these things that are taking place that, you know, ordinarily you would be reading about, hearing about in the radio. And I get to see with my eyes, try to interpret that and then show people the sort of, in a truthful manner, these things that I'm learning and witnessing. And that's, you know, gives me a huge sense of purpose, but it's also amazingly cool.
Can you tell when you're looking at something or when you're kind of thinking about something that, oh, this is going to be an awesome shot? Or does that kind of come later when you're looking at the film?
Almost all of the work that I do now is part of a larger story. So quite often, yeah, you'll come across a scenario which is very compelling and you think that there's going to be a great picture here and you work as hard as you can to make the best picture you can. But I think the pictures really come to life when they're part of a narrative and part of a larger picture or series of photographs, you know, online or in the newspaper, further on down the track. And what will often happen is you actually have to lose, you know, the strongest picture in order to create a stronger narrative. Because a strong picture will take so much attention away from the other photographs that you need to balance it out a little bit. But there are certainly moments when everything comes together, when all the elements are, you know, in one frame. I remember in Iraq, I've been working there for years, and the Marines had captured an insurgent. They had shot and captured him. He was wounded, and they were waiting for him to be evacuated. And they covered his head with a sweater, and a Marine was standing next to him guarding him, and his shadow was falling over the detainee. And I remember thinking, looking at this scene, it was dawn light, it was golden, it was like really a beautiful light and a moving scene. I remember thinking that for all of the time that I've spent in conflict, like, this is what represents war to me, this faceless idea, the silhouette of the American Marine, the faceless insurgent. Like, this is how men can fight, is when it's depersonalized, is when you're not looking at, you know, Johnny or Muhammad, when you're looking at a symbol. And it was a moment like that when I thought, like, okay, this is an image that I have to make sure I shoot something very powerful of, because this, to me, is what war looks like.
Well, that's interesting. I would assume that you, too, have to become not a person. You're not necessarily a spectator anymore, that you, too, have to become depersonalized to take some of these very, very powerful images or to see some of these moments of history in some of our hottest wars.
I'm not sure that you can ever depersonalize what you're looking at. But you definitely need to separate yourself, your emotions, occasionally from what it is that you're taking pictures of. And I think that the brain usually does that automatically. You know, when it's a really, really extreme situation, you know, like frontline combat, your brain will automatically go into a survival space in which you don't process the emotional ramifications of what it is you're actually looking at. That's not to say that they're not there. You know, you need, I think, in order to, for mental health, when you come back from these difficult traumatic situations, you need to go back and re-explore them and find out, you know, how it is you're feeling about them, what you do need to, you know, still process. And that can take years, because there's a good reason the brain shuts down and goes into survival mode during these times. So I think that, I mean, yeah, you're right. Like, there's, and it sounds almost inhuman, you know, to shut down like that, except I don't think that you could continue working through these places if you were emotionally sort of processing all of the stuff that happened. It's the same as a car crash victim. They'll forget what happened, and they have to revisit it and find out what it was and then try to process it and learn to live with it.
That's Ashley Gilbertson, a photographer and journalist who covered the war in Iraq and has also told the stories of U.S. service members who spent time in Afghanistan. You can see that powerful photo he just described of the detained insurgent on our website, kgou.org. Although we must warn you, it is graphic. We'll dive a little deeper into his projects, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot and Bedrooms of the Fallen, after a short break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, we're hearing from Ashley Gilbertson, a photographer who spent the past decade and a half telling the stories from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's been speaking with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Let's talk about one of your works published in 2007, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. So you talked earlier about kind of getting into these different spaces, being there for history, and you certainly were able to record that with these shots of the war in Iraq, looking at soldiers in Iraq. I'm curious as to where the title came from, and if you maybe could explain what the stories that you're trying to share here are.
Well, the title is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, which stands for WTF. So I actually didn't know what it meant when I was covering the war for the first couple of years. I would hear it on the radio occasionally, and I remember there was actually one situation in which a massive explosion went off, and it started raining like bricks and mortar and all this stuff down all over me and the unit that I was with. And the lieutenant got on the radio and screamed like Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, and I didn't think anything of it. But I came home and I Googled it. I'm like, oh my God, he had no idea what was going on either. So it turned into, you know, something which, for those of us that were actually on the ground, you know, I think that people in Washington, looking at this from, you know, 1,000 miles above and looking down, it was different. But for those of us that were on the ground, you know, in these little towns around Iraq, it felt like WTF. Like, what's going on here? You know, my job as a photographer is to translate, and I think this feeds into your second question, my job as a photographer, these stories, is to translate what foreign policy looks like on a ground level. You know, when somebody in Washington says, do this, how that's executed and what the ramifications of that are, it can be enormous, except they are too often ignored. It's looked at as policy rather than human. So my job is, you know, telling the stories of, in the case of Iraq, let's say, Iraqi civilians, Iraqi military, American military, and trying to humanize those stories to make decisions that we're making here in Washington, well, here in the United States and in Washington, based around the idea of compassion and empathy and humanity rather than, you know, cold numbers.
There was a lot in this past Iraqi war in regards to embedded reporters, embedded photographers. Did you ever feel that your life was endangered? You were certainly in some very tricky situations.
I don't think that you can fairly go to war and not expect to be put into some pretty dramatic situations. So, yeah, of course, it was remarkably dangerous at times. But that's part of the, you know, part of the package that you're buying into.
Again, this idea of your obligation or your responsibility to share the story. Well, a recent book that you have put together kind of takes the story to the aftermath, looking at the it's called The Bedrooms of the Fallen, and just that name gives me chills. But your concept here was to go to the homes of fallen soldiers across the world, really, looking at U.S., Canadian, and our allies, and seeing what their bedrooms still looked like, the families that lost their soldiers. Where did this idea come from, and what was this experience for you?
Well, after a lot of coverage from Iraq, I started feeling like the public was not responding to the type of work, you know, the type of photographs that I was taking, because basically I was taking the same picture over and over again and expecting people to still care. So I wasn't, in my opinion, I wasn't meeting my responsibility as a photojournalist in engaging my readers. I was filling a space in a newspaper, but I wasn't engaging. So I started looking at what I was missing in my photographs, which was the dead and wounded. That was very, very difficult to photograph in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I started trying to find ways that I might be able to draw attention to those issues back home, where there were less restrictions, where I had more access to a story like that. So I started, like, I camped out at Arlington National Cemetery, and I photographed families coming to visit their loved ones. I photographed memorials. I photographed funerals. I photographed a lot about post-traumatic stress and suicide. But after a couple of years of this, my wife and I were looking at the New York Times when they publish each 1,000 dead American soldiers and Marines. The New York Times would publish a double page of all of their headshots and their names and where they were from. My wife turned to me and said, you need to photograph their bedrooms. And, you know, for the next 7 years, until the book recently came out, it's what I've been doing. It's the most moving testament to who these men and women were, who they were in their lives rather than in their deaths. I realized that spending time looking at funerals and memorials in an Arlington National Cemetery, I was looking at their death and I was looking at what remained, which was the relatives and the friends. The reason they were sad is because they were grieving the absence of their loved one. And in these bedrooms is where we can feel that absence, but we can also feel what their lives were, how rich their lives were, how they expressed themselves. You know, like, I think as adults, well, as adults, we have a whole home, an apartment, a house, in which we can, you know, fill it with things that we love, things that mean something to us. But our kids, and the kids in this book, they're not kids, I know, they're grown-ups, but the soldiers and Marines in this book, they have one room in the house through which they can express themselves. That's the one place in the world that is theirs. So the rooms are really just this beautiful expression of who they were. I mean, there's one room in there, which is Christopher Scherer's room that I love. Chris apparently begged his dad for years, could I please put one sticker up on my wall? And his dad was like, no, no way, no stickers on the wall, you ruin the paint. Until finally, after 2 years, he said, yeah, okay. And then Chris's room just exploded. There's not an inch free on the wall anywhere. It's like Tyra Banks posters. It's shot glasses. It's a wanted poster of Bin Laden. It's the leprechauns made me do it. It's a U.S. flag hanging from the roof. It's a charcoal rubbing of Christopher Scherer, who died in the Vietnam War, from the memorial. It's every single thing this Chris seemed to have collected and stuck on his wall.
His family kept the room as it was.
His family kept the room exactly as it was. It's still exactly the same as it was then, today. I mean, I saw them on the weekend and Saturday, and they were saying that before he died, he had called home and said, you know, how are things going? And they said, well, actually, your dad's been offered a job down south. We're thinking about maybe taking it and moving down there. And he said, that sounds great. But before you go, make sure you take a saw and cut my room out and bring it with you. You know, I mean, his room, there's so many things in it. And the purpose of the book and of this work is that, you know, we learn who they were in their lives, but we find an object in one of these rooms that relates to your life. You know, like maybe you played lacrosse as a child and you look at Chris's room and you see the Tyra Banks and you see the shot glasses and you see all of this stuff, but then you see like the lacrosse sticks, and that's your connection to him. That's how you can start empathizing with his life. You know, through your life, it's like a doorway. And I think that once you find in each of these rooms that doorway, then you can start to really connect with who these people were. And, you know, there's 40 rooms, like you said, from our allies over in Europe, from Canada, and from the United States.
Such a moving tribute, and you say a way to humanize the situation and make us all feel attached to that. Well, always thinking about that responsibility that you feel to share these really, really important stories. Thank you so much for sharing them with us today, and we'll look for your next project soon.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with photographer Ashley Gilbertson. You can see a few of his photos and find links to much more of his work on our website. We also have an extra audio clip of him describing his next project and working in the medium of film. That's all at KGOU.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Symphony Swift serves as our research fellow and books our guests, and Sam Dupre and Brian Hardzinski produce the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Berlott.